This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and Broadcasting and Cable Magazine, sitting in for Terry Gross. Easter is coming up, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. We're going to take a historical look at crucifixion, which was a widespread form of punishment in antiquity. Our guest, John Dominic Crossan, is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and author of the books The Birth of Christianity, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? Crossan describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former Roman Catholic monk and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which investigates ancient historical evidence to help understand the life and times of Jesus. The seminar is controversial, in part because it does not take the Gospels literally and uses history to reconcile the different versions of Jesus' story as told in the four Gospels of the New Testament. Terry Gross spoke with John Dominic Crossan in 2004. He said crucifixion was practiced as a form of state terrorism for centuries before it became infamous under the Romans.
Now, who were some of the people that were typically punished with crucifixion?
In general, especially in the Roman situation, you can say almost definitely it was almost synonymous with the slaves' execution. It was a warning to other slaves not to flee, not to commit a crime, not, of course, to kill their master or mistress. And it was extremely public. Its point was not so much the amount of suffering, though, of course, it was a horrible suffering, but it was a public warning. You were literally hung up like a poster. Don't do what this person did, or you'll end up as this person did. So very much for the lower classes and especially for slaves.
Now, you say that during Roman times, crucifixion was one of three primary ways of capital punishment. There was crucifixion, being burned alive, and getting fed to the lions.
The Romans talked about suprema supplicia, supreme penalties, and they really didn't calculate them in terms of the amount of suffering. They really calculated them in terms of annihilation. So being crucified, being fed to the beasts, as it were, are being burned alive, the function was there would be nothing left to bury. So even when they were finished with your corpse, the relatives, the loved ones, would have nothing to bury. There'd be no tomb where they could mourn, where they could come to grieve, where they could even, say, eat with the beloved dead. They wished to annihilate you and to do it publicly.
Even with crucifixion?
The theory behind crucifixion actually was that you would be left on the cross until you were consumed by wild beasts or wild animals. Now, we know, for example, that there was one case in the first century because we have found the heel bone of a crucified person with the nail still in place, and this person was buried, honorably buried. So it is possible, of course. It depends upon whether maybe you could bribe the guards or have enough influence to get the body given to you. Then you could get the body back. But in theory, the purpose of crucifixion was to leave the body there until there was nothing left.
Was scourging or whipping usually the first step before crucifixion?
In general, scourging preceded crucifixion, and the function of scourging was to reduce resistance. They did not want a person, for example, staggering through the streets with a crossbar, cursing Rome or fighting them all the way. What you wanted, this was public spectacle, what you wanted was somebody reduced to the state that the most it could do was stagger, as it were, to crucifixion, unresisting. So yes, usually scourging would have preceded crucifixion.
How does Jesus' crucifixion, as described in the Gospels, compare with what is known historically about the procedures of crucifixion?
In general, the crucifixion itself, and in a way the Gospel has only one word, they crucified him. They don't describe the details that would show up, for example, in a play or a film. You don't have to decide if you're reading the Gospel, does Jesus carry only the crossbar or does he pull a huge cross and upright already in position? It simply says it crucified him. Another thing it does tell you is that the crime, as it were, the claim, the alleged claim of being king of the Jews was the sign given that you'd always have in a crucifixion, saying this is what this person did. So the crime is, as it were, hung around his neck or attached to the cross in some way. But everything that's said about the crucifixion of Jesus would fit quite well into what you'd expect in the first century crucifixion.
And it said he was scourged, and it said he was mocked.
The mocking is probably a separate issue, and in one sense, the mocking is terribly ironic because he's been mocked as a pseudo-king, and of course any reader of the Christian New Testament, the Christian Gospel, believes profoundly that he was a king, far more than Caesar was or Pilate as a local governor, that their mocking was profoundest truth. So the mock, in a way, the Gospel spends far more time, if you count the verses, I think there's about four verses on the mocking, and there's only one single word in Greek for the scourging. They wanted to describe the mocking because of the tremendous irony that the soldiers mocked him as a king. I have no idea whether that is historical or not. They certainly could have, but the point of insisting on it is the irony that he was being mocked as a king, and of course, we Christians who are reading this gospel believe him most profoundly to be king, not just of the Jews, but of the world.
When did the cross become a symbol of Christianity?
Very, 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 very slowly and cautiously. In the time before Constantine, that is, before the beginning of the 4th century, when Christianity became more or less the official religion of the Roman Empire, you have very, very many mentions, of course, from Paul's letters on of the cross, of the crucifixion. But you don't see pictures of it. The very earliest one we have, actually, of the crucifixion is, again, we're back to the mocking. A page in the Palatine Palace in Rome was mocking a fellow page who apparently was a Christian. His name was Alexandros. So the page scratched on the wall of their dormitory, as it were, a model of the crucifixion in which Jesus is portrayed with the head of a donkey. And written underneath it is, Alexander worships his God. And probably that's the only way it would have been shown as a mocking of the crucifixion until after the victory of Constantine.
Have you thought about if so many people were crucified, if it was such a common form of execution, why did that become the symbol for Jesus Christ?
The crucifix only became, or the cross only became the symbol for Jesus always as accompanied by the resurrection. I mean, this is two things, execution, resurrection, mm-hmm. death, resurrection, always the two things. Because, of course, the point is that Jesus was officially, legally, publicly executed by Rome. It wasn't that Pilate made a mistake or that Pilate simply was rounding up people and he grabbed Jesus by mistake. Jesus was executed by the normalcy of the civilization of his day. Then, of course, when you say that God raised Jesus from the dead, you've got two things on a collision course. Rome crucified Jesus. God raised Jesus. Then the inference is very clear. This God we're talking about is on a collision course with Rome because God had, as it were, countermanded the official decree of Rome. And so if you take away the resurrection, then the crucifixion becomes almost meaningless, or you have to get into another theology in which the crucifixion is the center of Christianity all by itself.
When you, as someone who studies the historical Jesus, think about the resurrection, do you think about it as metaphor or as actuality?
I think of it, I would not make the distinction of metaphor or actuality. I would make the distinction of metaphor or literal, because metaphors can be very actual. For example, the metaphor for me is that to claim resurrection for Jesus, and I can leave it completely, whether you take it metaphorically or literally, either way, what you are claiming is that something has happened here which is going to change the way the world sees everything. And I think that is right, because the claim you're making is that God has reversed the normalcy of civilization. And that's why it's very important for me to insist that Pilate, from his point of view, got it right. He looked at Jesus. He said, this person resists our law and order, as it were, not a violent resistor, or I'd have rounded up all his followers like I rounded up Barabbas's. But yes, he resists us, and therefore he must be publicly executed. Now, to say that God has reversed that decision puts God on a collision course with the normalcy of civilization. That, I believe, is actual, because I believe in what happened at the death of Jesus is that we were confronted with a warning that violence is going to destroy us. We got a warning that if you do not resist evil nonviolently, violence will destroy us. I think something did happen, because that was a warning, and we have not been heeding it for 2,000 years.
With the resurrection, do you think that there was some kind of physical transformation that happened to the actual body of Jesus?
No, I don't. I am completely convinced that Jesus had told people before his death that the kingdom of God has already arrived and that we have begun to participate with God in what I'm going to call the great cleanup. The fancy word for that is eschatological consummation. The great cleanup of the world, the attempt to make it a just place. I am absolutely certain also, historically I'm speaking, that people had visions of Jesus after his execution. They had visions, they are not hallucinations. They are visions, they are apparitions of Jesus. When they put those two things together, they said, then Jesus has risen as the beginning of the general resurrection. That's the only thing the word could have meant to them. It's not a personal, private privilege for Jesus. He has risen as the head of those who have died before him and as the promise of those who will die after him. I take that metaphorically. I do not take it actually. I do not think all around Jerusalem on Easter Sunday morning there were hundreds of empty tombs. And I don't think the people who believed in the harrowing of hell ever suggested, let's go out and check the tombs of the prophets to see if they're gone. I think they knew quite well what they were saying. They were saying something which they took metaphorically and which we take literally. And I think we've kind of lost the actuality.
I know that you've seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and I'm wondering if you could give us your short review of how the Jesus story is told in the movie.
Basically, there's a couple of things that any passion story or passion drama does. You take the four Gospels, and there are four of them, by the way, and you reduce them to one. And then you reduce that one Gospel to simply execution. And then you reduce that execution to passio, the Latin word for passion, meaning suffering. So everything coalesces on the suffering of Jesus. Therefore, for example, there is nothing in Mel Gibson's movie, except brief flashbacks, more to increase the poignancy, about the life of Jesus. So by the time you come to the execution, and the resurrection, of course, is even more fleeting in this movie, you have no idea why anyone at all, would want this person dead, let alone executed publicly. You don't even understand it. Nor do you understand why, for example, it begins with a nighttime arrest of Jesus accompanied by Judas, who betrays him. Why was that necessary? Couldn't the authorities have grabbed him any time they wanted? Well, if you've been reading the story from Palm Sunday on, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as we would say, of that week, the crowd is all on the side of Jesus. It's said again and again and again in the gospel. The high priestly authorities are afraid to move because the crowd are on the side of Jesus. And in Mark 14, 1 to 2, they give up. They finally say, well, we can't do it during the festival. There'll be a riot. Then comes Judas. And Judas says, I can arrange it. I can arrange that you'll get him apart from the crowd at night. So what is not in this movie at all is that the whole Jewish crowd in Jerusalem is so much on the side of Jesus that it requires this nighttime arrest and an apostolic traitor to get him.
When did passion plays become popular? When did it become popular to focus stories on the suffering, the crucifixion and suffering of Christ?
The emphasis on the suffering of Christ, almost the exclusion of everything else, is really a very much a medieval idea and may well reflect the experiences of people. If people are suffering, and I mean seriously suffering, say with plague or something like that or invasion, then to think of the sufferings of Jesus is extremely consoling. And the script that Mel Gibson used from The Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ, according to the Meditations of Anne Catherine Emmerich, is a good example. She had a life of suffering. She had a life of hardship, an Augustinian nun who spent the last 10 years of her life bedridden in great pain. And no wonder, of course, that she had an almost mystical union with the sufferings of Jesus, because she herself was in intense suffering. So the emphasis on suffering is, how shall I say it, appropriate maybe even necessary for people in intolerable pain. Outside that, it becomes dangerously close to pathological.
What do you mean by pathological?
I mean, when you start to focus on suffering and the whole meaning of, say, Jesus' life being reduced, and that verb is carefully chosen, reduced to suffering, it is not the way anyone thought about it in the first century. The Romans did not compute suffering. They didn't say we have to make this person suffer as much as possible, or they would have kept him in the barracks and tortured him for weeks on end. Their purpose was not suffering, but public warning. So when you bring it all down to suffering, it's very hard to show it without sadism.
Now, something that I find a little confusing, when we were talking a little earlier about crucifixion, you were explaining that for most Roman crucifixions, the dead body was left on the cross to be eaten by the birds of prey and by the wild dogs. And part of that was punishment for the family. The family would not be given the remains to be buried. There'd be no tomb, there'd be no remains. But the remains of Jesus is such a fundamental part of the Christ story. Do you think an exception was made for him, that there were remains, that there was a body?
It's utterly possible, because of the Philo, for example, does mention the possibility of a body being given back to the family. And in a way, it's not so much a punishment for the family as a punishment for the person, because they're being annihilated. And we have the crucified heel bone of somebody who was honorably buried. So it is utterly possible that in an exceptional cases, either because you bribed the guards or because you were able to get some influence, it was utterly possible to get the body and give the body normal burial. Now, the problem is that the Jewish law of Deuteronomy says by nightfall the body must be off the cross. I have no evidence, and that's, I would say, I expect that the Romans did not follow Jewish law, because the purpose of crucifixion was to let you die in agony on the cross. And if the person, let's imagine a case in which the person was only crucified by late in the afternoon, they would not be taken down from the cross. So the question is, and this is the question, is the story of Joseph of Arimathea in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or of Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus in John, is that an historical record of what happened? Or that is that Christians' best hope of what they hope might have happened without knowing what happened to the body of Jesus?
So you think that the Gospels might be more about that hope than the reality, more about hope than journalism?
Here is the problem. When you look at Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, the story of the burial of Jesus, knowing that Mark is the basis for Matthew and Luke, and that possibly, this is debated in scholarship, they may be the source for John. You watch the body's burial get steadily better. It's a hasty, hurried burial in Mark. By the time Matthew and Luke read Mark and develop the story, it's burial in a tomb in which nobody else has been laid, and they're explaining to you why Joseph of Arimathea was able to be a counselor for Jesus, but not against him on Thursday night, as it were. The story is developing, and by the time you get to John's account, the burial of Jesus is, I wouldn't even say royal, it's transcendental. There is so much spices used that they would fill almost the entire tomb. It's a magnificent burial. It's the burial of the Son of God when you get to John. Now, what happens is, as a historian, when I retroject that trajectory of a burial getting better and better and better, and I ask what was there in the beginning, it doesn't look very good. It looks to me like all they might have had at the very beginning is a hope that maybe some pious, non-Christian Jew, out of respect for the law of Deuteronomy, would have buried Jesus' body. But that immediately then raises the issue that they see. Well, wouldn't he also have buried the two robbers who were crucified with Jesus? And wouldn't there be at least three in the tomb? And would it be a public tomb for criminals? And then how would we know which was Jesus's body? And so you can see them, I think, grappling with the difficulties of a story which I don't think is historical. I think it is their fervent hope, their best hope, that somebody took care of the body of Jesus. But none of that, by the way, in any way, is for or against resurrection, because resurrection is a new creation by God.
John Dominic Crossan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure as always, Terry.
John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2004. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Levon Helm, was the drummer in the group The Band. That's the group that backed Bob Dylan after he went electric and went on to become famous in its own right after the release of the 1968 album Music from Big Pink, which featured Helm singing lead on The Wait. In December, Helm released his first solo album in 25 years. It won a Grammy Award last month as Best Traditional Folk Album. It's called Dirt Farmer, and it features traditional songs and contemporary songs in that style. When Dirt Farmer was released, the Washington Post Review described it as, quote, an exquisitely unvarnished monument to Americana for a man whose keening lyrical vocals have become synonymous with it, unquote. It's remarkable that Helm's singing is this good after he was diagnosed as having cancer in his vocal cords in 1998. He was able to start singing again in 2004. For the past 4 years, he's presided over what he calls his midnight rambles, intimate concerts with his famous and not-so-famous friends at the barn that's become his home recording studio in Woodstock, New York. Terry spoke with Levon Helm in December. Let's start with the opening track from Dirt Farmer.
That's Levon Helm from his new CD, Dirt Farmer. Levon Helm, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I wasn't sure what to expect when I put your CD on because I knew about your vocal cancer. And your singing is so great on this, and it's so full out. And I'm wondering if the act of singing has changed for you, either technically or emotionally, since your recovery.
You know, it's a it's a lot more fun for me these days. I'm not quite as hard on myself as I used to be, and I still haven't fallen in love with the sound of my voice, but I am able to get some satisfaction when we try and do these tunes, and it takes me a little while sometimes, but it's an interesting process.
So I know that your doctor, your first doctor told you that he'd perform surgery and you'd need a voice box, but after the second opinion, you went with radiation treatments instead, which seemed to be effective in stopping the cancer. But were you able to imagine life with a voice box?
I couldn't. It was just a horrible thing, you know, to face. Since then, I have friends, of course, that have faced it and have conquered it. So it's you know, it's just one of those burdens that some of us have to bear. My saving grace was to run into Dr. Kraus down at Sloan Kettering in New York, and and they certainly saved my bacon.
Let's hear another song from your new CD, Dirt Farmer, and I want to play The Blind Child. I really love your recording of this. I wasn't familiar with the song before. How do you know the song?
Oh, that's one of those old back porch songs that my dad and my mom and my aunts and uncles used to sing and play for each other. Those were Blind Child and Little Birds and The Girl I Left Behind. Those were some of the first songs that we started with. Those were the working title, the original working title was Songs from Home.
Well, let's hear Blind Child, and this is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
They tell me, Father, that tonight you'll wed another bride, that you will clasp her in your arms where my dear mother died. They say her name is Mary too. So soft and light, her voice so meek and mild. And tell me, Father, will she love your blind and helpless child? Is resting on the shelf. Her books are lying here, and there's the harp her fingers touched. There's her vacant chair, the chair whereby her side I knelt to say clothes, need this little dark curly hair, and the very last words that the blind child spoke, there'll be no blind ones there. No, the very last words that the blind child spoke, there'll be no blind ones there.
That's Blind Child from Levon Helm's new album, Dirt Farmer. You said you learned this song as a child. Did the song scare you as a child because it's about a child who's blind and whose mother's died? And it's a really tragic song.
Yes, it is. It's one of those story songs, a true-to-life kind of a song. And those were the songs that people really went for back then. Anything else was suspect. It could be something that somebody just made up, you know, with no real bearing to it. So songs like that were the ones that had lasted and stood the test of time when my folks came along.
You know, I'm interested in the fact that you've done an album of largely traditional songs and more contemporary songs written in the manner of traditional songs. You know, I listened back to our 1993 interview a few days ago. And I had quoted to you something in your memoir, which was published in 93, and you had said that you were reluctant to record with Dylan initially because you thought Dylan was too folky. And in the interview, you said we, meaning your band at the time, the Hawks, we were more into R&B and blues music. We weren't big folk fans. We liked horns, rhythm sections. We liked the full house on the bandstand. And Bob Dylan was coming from more of a troubadour kind of place, just him and his guitar. What happened between then and now to change your mind about recording folk music?
Well, it sounds like we all got religion, don't it? Yeah, you know, what I meant to say, I guess, is I still kind of feel that way. I'm a drummer, and Bob was a strummer without a drummer when we first ran into each other. So, you know, I'm just not drawn to songs that don't involve a set of drums and a full rhythm section.
Since 2006, you've been doing Midnight Rambles.
Yeah.
At your home and studio.
Uh-huh.
And these are just, you describe what they are.
Well, they're basically music parties. We have, you know, two, three, sometimes one a week, at least two or three a month. And we have them on Saturday nights in Woodstock at the studio. And it started out as basically a modern version of the old-fashioned rent party, but since then, the musicians that have taken part in it have really raised it to another level. And I guess it's 3 years going on 4 years later now, and we have people that are coming in from all over the place to celebrate with us. And that includes the players, too.
Did you need it as a rent party? Because I know after you got sick, you had to declare bankruptcy.
This is true. Well, it started off as a rent party, so to speak. It looked like the studio was going to be put on the blocks because I was in pretty rough shape financially. And just as I started to kind of get my my voice back and I was able to work a little more, is when we tried the Midnight Ramble. And it paid the rent, so we basically kept it up. And now this much later, it's really turned into a benefit for a lot of the players.
Now, you named the Midnight Ramble after concerts that you saw as a child growing up in Arkansas. Describe the Midnight Rambles that yours are named after.
Well, there used to be one of my favorite traveling tent shows at the time was an outfit called, it was called the F.S. Walcott's Original Rabbit's Foot Minstrels. And this was a big four-poler, five-poler tent that they set up, and they parked two of the big tractor-trailer flatbeds side to side to make the stage, put the tent around that, and they had a chorus line, a band, a troupe of singers, dancers, and players, and they would put on in these small towns through the South. They would play every week, and you would go to the concert. At the end of the concert, which would be over around 10:30, 11, they would offer a Midnight Ramble ticket. And for the people who could stay up late, all the kids were supposed to go home and get ready for school or Sunday school. And the grown-ups could stay and buy an extra ticket and get an extra half hour, 45 minutes of music and spicier jokes. And one of the prettiest girls in the chorus line would do a little hoochie-coochie, and what a show.
Well, is there's no like hoochie coochie in your Midnight Ramble, is there?
You know, we've almost had it break out a couple of times. Amy and Larry Campbell's mom the other night jumped up and started doing a little hoochie coochie.
Now, getting back to the Midnight Rambles, which are kind of like house parties, but on a very elevated level. You write in your memoir that your father used to perform weekends at house parties.
Oh, yeah.
Did he
yeah.
tell you stories about that, or were you old enough to go to any of them when he was still doing it?
Well, you know, by the time that I got old enough to go, televisions were just starting to come out, and we didn't get electricity and didn't have one yet, but the trend was started towards couch potato and you know, just the participation generation was going by the wayside. And I didn't have a chance to play many of those house parties. I got to go to a few as a young kid. I remember one night they had one at my uncle's house. And my Uncle Pudge, who also played guitar, and I had a big grocery box, pasteboard box, and I beat that thing to death that night. I was I volunteered to play percussion. But that was the old, move the furniture out of the biggest room, and a guitar player, a fiddle player, and maybe a mandolin player was about the strength of the band.
Let me choose another song from the new CD. This is Single Girl, Married Girl, which I believe is another song that you grew up with.
Well, it's just another one of those songs. It's kind of in that same area there, and it gave me as a drummer another opportunity to kind of monkey up the beat of a traditional country rhythm.
So here it is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
One, two, three.
That's Single Girl, Married Girl from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer. There's such great harmonies on your CD, and your daughter Amy does most of the harmony singing on this.
Well, that's Amy and Teresa Williams, Larry Campbell's wife, and that's one of the great gifts from Dirt Farmer for me is the sound of Amy and Teresa's harmonies. We didn't know before Dirt Farmer that they would blend and sound the way they sound together.
I've asked this to other performers who have ended up performing with their adult children. But when your daughter was born, did you ever think, this is my future performing partner? She's just arrived.
No, I never did. I guess I had the same hopes for Amy that my parents had for me. I wanted Amy to be a scholar. You know, my parents wanted me to be smart and be a scholar, and the best I could do was graduate high school. And bless her heart, Amy, I got to say, she did finish school out at Wisconsin and made a beautiful picture of her in her graduating robe, and I'm so proud of her. But the same bug bit Amy that bit me, and she fell back in with the rhythm section as soon as she got out of school.
Your father was a cotton farmer but performed on weekends. What kind of songs would he do, the kinds of songs you've done on your new CD?
You know, he would probably have done, things like the up-tempo stuff that we do on Dirt Farmer. Some of those tunes he would have done. And I know one of the old songs, we didn't do it in this recording phase, but Setting on Top of the World was an old favorite back then. Now, don't you come here running, holding out your hand. I've been your daddy, I've been your man, but now I'm gone, and I ain't worried. I'm sitting on top of the world.
Yeah, and didn't Cream record that too? And of course, Bob Wills.
You know, I think they did, and yeah. I'm sure my dad, you know, jumped the beat up like Cream did, you know, to make it as danceable as possible.
Now you performed with your sister when you were a teenager and won a lot of contests.
Uh huh.
This is your younger sister.
Yeah.
Okay. And you read in your memoir that, you know, in those performances, you would play harmonica, jew's harp, and slap your thighs. Are there ever occasions that musically that call for thigh slapping now?
Well, you know, that's the old ham bone trick. When I was coming through school, that was one of the things that you wanted to learn how to do was ham bone. And that's, you know, how you slap your hand on your leg and your chest. Like, I don't know if you can hear it or not, but I... Like that. And it was just one of those things that you learned as a kid, you know, in South Arkansas schools, and not knowing how to play guitar or anything. That was my first reaction to music.
So you were doing that before you had a drum kit.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about your music, but you've also been in a few films, including Coal Miner's Daughter, The Right Stuff, and most recently you were in The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which was directed by Tommy Lee Jones, who also starred in it. And you have a small but terrific part in it. And I want to play that scene. Tommy Lee Jones in the movie is going across the desert to bury his friend in the small town that his friend wanted to be buried in. So he's on this kind of like almost epic journey, taking the corpse, like dragging the corpse to the burial place. And he comes upon you, a blind man living alone in the middle of nowhere, and you make a very unusual request. Here's the scene.
I'd like to ask you a favor.
Anything you want.
I wanted to ask you, if you can shoot me. My son ain't coming back.
Oh, he'll come back.
No, he told me he had cancer. And he told me to go back to town with him. But I don't want to go, because I've always lived here.
No, we can't do it.
I don't want to offend God by killing myself. It's a problem.
We don't want to offend God either.
It'd be the best thing to do. You're good people. You need to go ahead and shoot me.
What a great scene. What did you do to get into character? You play a blind man who I think is probably older than you are. You have scars and everything, you know, around your eyes. So did you just kind of walk in and do it, or did you, like, prepare?
No, I'm just one of those guys that goes in and tries to do it. I don't know enough about it to prepare myself. You know, I try and sleep as good as I can, and just enjoy it. I enjoy being with people who do know how to do that stuff. And I've never had anything but a good time around any of those shows that I've had the opportunity to be part of.
You know, your new CD is dedicated to your parents. And you perform on that CD with your daughter. Are you surprised now at the power of blood? And I ask that knowing that, like, you know, you left Arkansas at a pretty young age. And traveling around as a musician around the world, as you did with the band, I would imagine it would be easy to lose track of your family. But family in your early life and certainly now is so essential. I mean, the way you describe it, your daughter helped you survive. She took you to your radiation treatments in New York every week during the duration. She sings with you now. She co-produced the record. So I'm wondering if, like, you know, family ties have a different meaning to you than you thought they would have when you were, say, in your 20s or 30s?
They are stronger for me now, and I've always appreciated my family and friends, you know, and those ties that bind us together. But it's like my music. This much later, and after you've almost got everything taken away from you, once you get that back, boy, it's a joyful life that we've all been given. And you know, you can really, you know, when you see a young nephew or a young person in your family that's blood related, and you see them for the first time, and they're not old enough to know that you're all related, but you can look into their face, and they look into your eyes, and you both know it. You know, we take it for granted, and you know, we enjoy that kind of thing without even a big thank you most of the time.
Thank you so much for talking with us. And
Thank you, Terry, for calling. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for playing the record.
We're really glad you're recording again and performing.
Oh, me too. Thank you,
thank
honey.
You.
Levon Helm speaking to Terry Gross last December. Dirt Farmer, his first solo album in 25 years, recently won the Grammy for Best Traditional Folk Album. Levon Helm and his band are on tour this spring and summer, including appearances at the Bonnaroo Music and Arts Festival in June and the Newport Folk Festival in August. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.